Eventually, their control of that market led IG Farben to become one of the biggest and most important commercial chemical manufacturers in the entire world, and by far the most important in Germany and in Europe. And again, we're talking about the connections between General Motors and IG Farben. Later on, IG Farben went on, this is all in parenthetically, by the way, this last bit is not out of the book, but later on, IG Farben went on to become a leading backer of Hitler's military machine, one of the leading manufacturers of things to be used for the war machine, and their treatment of their use of prisoners as slave labor, working them to death at the Auschwitz IG Farben plant, led several members of the IG Farben board of directors to actually be tried as war criminals and convicted, although their sentences were not particularly stringent.
Also, IG Farben's throwing of its support to Hitler is generally regarded as one of the decisive factors in assuring his rise to power.
All right. Again, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. On several visits with Hermann Schmitz and Karl Krauk of Farben in Berlin in 1933, Wendell R. Swint, S-W-I-N-T, DuPont's foreign relations director, discovered that IG and the gigantic Krupp industrial empire had arranged for all Nazi industry to contribute 0.5% of its entire wage and salary roll to the Nazis, even before they rose to power. Thus, Swint, who testified to this effect at the 1934 munitions hearings, admitted under oath that DuPont was fully aware it was financing the Nazi party through 0.5% of its Opel wages and salaries, as well as through its deals with IG and its building of armored cars and trucks. Simultaneously with the rise of Hitler, the DuPonts in 1933 began financing native fascist groups in America, including the anti-Semitic and anti-black American Liberty League and the organization known as Clark's Crusaders, which had 1,250,000 members in 1933. Pierre Irénée and Lamotte DuPont and John Jacob Raskob funded the Liberty League along with Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors. The League smeared Roosevelt as a communist, claimed the president was surrounded by Jews, and, despite the fact that they were Jewish, the DuPonts smeared Semitic organizations. The connections between General Motors and the Nazi government began at the moment of Hitler's rise to power. Goering declined to annex General Motors, and indeed received with pleasure William S. Knudsen, General Motors president, who returned on October 6, 1933 to New York, telling reporters that Germany was, quote, the miracle of the 20th century.
Early in 1934, Irénée DuPont and Knudsen reached their explosion point over President Roosevelt. Along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, recall that the Morgan Financial Group includes DuPont Chemicals, Morgan Bank, and General Motors, beginning again, along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, certain DuPont backers financed a coup d'etat that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. Who was to be the figurehead for this ill-advised scheme, which would result in Roosevelt being forced to take orders from businessmen as part of a fascist government, or face the alternative of imprisonment and execution? DuPont men allegedly held an urgent series of meetings with the Morgans. They finally settled on one of the most popular soldiers in America, General Smedley Butler of Pennsylvania. Butler, a brave hero, had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and his brilliant career as Commandant of the Marine Corps had made him a legend. He would, the conspiratorial group felt, make an ideal replacement for Roosevelt if the latter proved difficult. These business chiefs found great support for their plan in Hermann Schmitz, Baron von Schroeder, and the other German members of the fraternity. Interrupting here, the fraternity is a name that Charles Higham has applied to this cozy group of German and American industrialists and financiers who formed what, I guess for lack of a better term, we could call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that essentially was the focus of our Uncle Sam in the broadcast and which we're looking at in part tonight. So that's what Higham means here by the fraternity. Continuing, the backers of the bizarre conspiracy selected a smooth attorney, Gerald McGuire, to bring word of the plan to General Butler. McGuire agreed Butler would be the perfect choice. Butler had attacked the New Deal in public speeches. McGuire met with Butler at the latter's house in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, and in a hotel suite nearby. With great intensity, the fascist attorney delivered the scheme to the general. Butler was horrified. Although there were many things about Roosevelt he disliked, a coup d'etat amounted to treason, and Butler was nothing if not loyal to the Constitution. However, he disclosed nothing of his feelings. With masterful composure, he pretended interest and waited to hear more. When McGuire returned, it was with news of more millions and more extravagant plans, which included turning America into a dictatorship with Butler as a kind of Hitler. Once more, Butler was infuriated but kept quiet. After McGuire left on the second occasion, the general got in touch with the White House. He told Roosevelt of the entire plan. Roosevelt's state of mind can scarcely be imagined. He knew that in view of the backing from high banking sources, this matter could not be dismissed as some crackpot enterprise that had no chance of success. He was well aware of the powerful forces of fascism that could easily make America an ally of Nazism, even that early, only 1 year after Hitler had risen to power. On the other hand, Roosevelt also knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States. That's worth mentioning here, worth remembering here, that Roosevelt was quite aware that he was not the most powerful man in the country. John Kennedy found that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the plan had to be deactivated immediately. The answer was to leak it to the press. The newspaper ran the story of the attempted coup on the front page, but generally ridiculed it as absurd and preposterous. When Thomas Lamont of the Morgan Bank arrived from Europe by steamer, he was asked by a crowd of reporters to comment. "Perfect moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon," unquote, was the reply. Roosevelt couldn't quite let the matter rest. Under pressure from liberal Democrats, he set up a special House committee to investigate. Butler begged the committee to summon the DuPonts, but the committee declined, nor would it consent to call anyone from the House of Morgan. Then Butler dropped a bombshell. He gave interviews to the press announcing that none other than General Douglas MacArthur was a party to the plot. This again was dismissed by the press, and MacArthur laughed it off. Interrupting here, MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. That's one of the reasons this was such a bombshell. Before Niptuck continues here, note here that we have some of the most powerful financiers and industrialists in America financing a proposed military coup d'etat. This is a matter of public record, although the record has been obscured. It's worth underscoring the point here because most Americans don't really think of the United States as a place where a military coup might take place. And our point is that this has been attempted in the past.
Okay. The committee hearings were a farce. McGuire was allowed to get away with saying that Butler had, quote, misunderstood his intentions. Other witnesses lamely made excuses, and there the matter rested. It was 4 years before the committee dared to publish its report in a white paper that was marked for, quote, restricted circulation. They were forced to admit that, quote, certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. The committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, unquote. This admission that the entire plan was deadly in intent was not accompanied by the imprisonment of anybody. Further investigations disclosed that over 1 million people had been guaranteed to join the scheme, and that the arms and munitions necessary would have been supplied by Remington, a DuPont subsidiary. The DuPont's fascistic behavior was seen in 1936. When Irenae DuPont used General Motors money to finance the notorious Black Legion, this terrorist organization had as its purpose the prevention of automobile workers from unionizing. The members wore hoods and black robes with skull and crossbones. They firebombed union meetings, murdered union organizers, often by beating them to death, and dedicated their lives to destroying Jews and communists. They linked to the Ku Klux Klan. Irenae DuPont encouraged General Motors' foreman to join the Legion. In one episode, a Detroit worker, Charles Poole, was brutally murdered by a gang of Black Legionists, several of whom belonged to the sinister Wolverine Republican League of Detroit. This organization had as its members several in big business. However, their names were kept out of the papers during the Poole case trial. It was brought out at the last that at least 50 people, many of them blacks, had been butchered by the Legion, which swept through General Motors factories and had 75,000 members. At the same time, the DuPonts developed the American Liberty League, a Nazi organization whipping up hatred of blacks and Jews, love of Hitler, and loathing of the Roosevelts. financed by Lamont and Irénée to the tune of close to $500,000 the first year, the Liberty League had a lavish 31-room office in New York, branches in 26 colleges, and 15 subsidiary organizations nationwide that distributed 50 million copies of its Nazi pamphlets. In September 1936, while Hitler at Nuremberg expressed his grand design for the four-year plan, the DuPonts and the American Liberty League poured thousands into backing Republican Alf Landon against Roosevelt in that election. Other backers were the American Nazi Party and the German-American Bund. I should just mention I'll mention later on. Go ahead.
Okay, now, again, before continuing with this, not only have the DuPonts and the Morgan Group attempted a coup in this country, their exposure in attempting to do that didn't back them off one bit. They proceeded to plunge wholeheartedly into the financing of American domestic American fascism. Continuing here, the attempt to launch Landon failed, which made the DuPonts hate Roosevelt even more. In outright defiance of Roosevelt's desire to improve working conditions for the average man, Knudsen of General Motors, along with the DuPonts, instituted the speed-up systems created by another prominent figure of the fraternity, Charles Bedeaux, B-E-D-A-U-X. These forced men to work at terrifying speeds on the assembly lines. Many died of the heat and the pressure, increased by fear of losing their jobs at a time when there were very few available. Irénée personally paid almost $1 million from his own pocket for armed and gas-equipped stormtroops modeled on the Gestapo to sweep through the plants and beat up anyone who proved rebellious. He hired the Pinkerton Agency to send its swarms of detectives through the whole chemicals, munitions, and automobile empire to spy on left-wingers or other malcontents. By the mid-1930s, General Motors was committed to full-scale production of trucks, armored cars, and tanks in Nazi Germany. By the way, that's the mid-1930s. Continuing, the GM board could be guaranteed to preserve political, personal, and commercial links to Hitler. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, who was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Let me read that last sentence again. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Others present, delivering equally Hitlerian addresses, were Governor Eugene D. Talmadge of Georgia, his son became a senator from that state, by the way, and the Nazi Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith. Remember the name Gerald L. K. Smith, we'll come back to him. Sloan frequently visited Berlin, where he hobnobbed with Goering and Hitler. Graham K. Howard was a vice president of General Motors. Under FBI surveillance throughout his whole career with the company, he was an outright fascist who wrote a poisonous book, America and a New World Order, that peddled the line of appeasement and a virtually identical doctrine to that of Hitler in terms of free trade and the restoration of the gold standard for the United States of fascism, in which General Motors would no doubt play a prominent part. Note that he refers to the United States of fascism here.
Yes, and bear in mind, this is the same General Motors they're talking about, of whom one of their presidents, one of GM's presidents, once said, "What's good for GM is good for America." Reading on, another frequent visitor to Germany was the rugged, cheerful, hearty James D. Mooney, head of the European end of the business, directly in charge of the Atom Opel production. On December 22, 1936, in Vienna, Mooney told U.S. diplomat George Messerschmitt, who, despite his German family origin, hated Hitler, quote, "We ought to make some arrangements with Germany for the future. There is no reason why we should let our moral indignation over what happens in that country stand in the way." In other words, although the mass of Americans despised the Nazis, business must continue as usual. Messerschmitt was furious. He snapped back, "We can hardly be expected to trade with a country only so that it can get those articles which it intends to use against the peace of the world," unquote. In a report of December 23rd to the acting Secretary of State in Washington, Messerschmitt wrote, quote, "It is curious that Mooney and Colonel Sosthenes Bain, B-E-H-N, both give this opinion. The factories owned by IT&T in Germany are running full-time and in double shifts and increasing their capacity for the simple reason that they are working almost entirely on government orders and for military equipment. The Opel Works, owned by General Motors, are also working very well in the same way. That Christmas, Mooney was in Berlin for talks with Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht to discuss Germany's and America's joint future in the world of commerce. He attracted the hatred of the liberal U.S. ambassador to Germany, William E. Dodd, who returned from Berlin to New York in 1937, and referred to the fraternity, again, the author Haim's name for this grouping of industrialists, who referred to the fraternity in a shipboard press conference in New York Harbor. Dodd was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government, and is working closely with the fascist regimes in Germany and Italy. I have had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. On the ship, a fellow passenger, who is a prominent executive of one of the largest financial corporations, told me point blank that he would be ready to take definite action to bring fascism into America if President Roosevelt continued his progressive policies," unquote. Okay, now, again, we've talked, it may seem like we've branched off slightly in talking about participation of DuPont and GM with Nazi Germany and the Nazi war machine in Europe. But if you'll remember also, we started out talking about people like Wesley Swift and Richard Butler and Aryan Nations and William Potter Gale and Identity. And we mentioned the fact that William Potter Gale was on the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. We also mentioned that the GM and DuPont people tried to finance a coup d'etat attempt to take over the White House and either imprison or execute Franklin Roosevelt, and they approached Major General Smedley D. Butler to be essentially the American Hitler, and lead the military to perform this coup. Now, these two trails, William Potter Gale and his later building up of the Identity Movement and the Morgan GM DuPont-sponsored coup attempt are going to start tying together.
Okay, now, remember that General Douglas MacArthur was reportedly involved in this plot to overthrow the government of the United States. Again, this was going to be a simple military coup. Now, Smedley Butler, who was the fellow who was picked to lead that plot, testified that MacArthur was involved with the plotters, although he did testify at one point that he wasn't sure if MacArthur was aware of the plans. Still, in many other times when he gave testimony, he implicated MacArthur directly in the plot. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at are some of MacArthur's connections. But again, remember Douglas MacArthur's role as basically the one of the proposed agents of the DuPont Rockefeller, or the DuPont Morgan Financial Group here, okay? Because that's an industrial group. That is essentially why we went into that particular group, to show that one of the most powerful alliances of financiers and industrialists in this country was openly pro-Hitler, as we've talked about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that moreover they were willing to overthrow the democratic government of the United States and were very active in funding domestic fascism. Still more about the attempted coup in 1934. This is from a book called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer. It's copyrighted in 1973 by Hawthorne Books. The interview here is between Jules Archer and former Speaker of the House John McCormick, who was co-chairman of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, the House committee set up to investigate the coup. Archer's interrogation or questioning of McCormick goes as follows. "I asked McCormick what his own reactions had been to McGuire's testimony denying all of Butler's allegations. There was no doubt that General Butler was telling the truth," he replied. We believed his testimony 100%. He was a great, patriotic American in every respect." Skipping down, Jules Archer asks, "Had the plotters only wanted to take over the White House to restore the gold standard, or were they also out to destroy the New Deal and set up a fascist dictatorship to run the country through an American Mussolini?" McCormick reflected a moment, then said, "Well, we were in the depths of a severe recession, and we had a good man, Roosevelt, in the White House, and he'd revived the hopes and confidence of the American people. The plotters definitely hated the New Deal because it was for the people, not for the moneyed interests, and they were willing to spend a lot of their money to dump Mr. Roosevelt out of the White House. Could you say definitely that the American Liberty League was the organization of big fellows that McGuire had described as being behind the plotters?" "I don't know anything about the Liberty League," he replied in a crisp manner that did not encourage me to pursue any further interrogation along that line. Mr. Speaker, why were the plotters so insistent that General Butler accept their proposal that he be the one to head the fascist march on Washington they planned? They chose Smedley Butler because they needed an enlisted man's general, not a general's general, unquote. They had to have a colorful figure. A half a million or more veterans who had been privates and non-coms would follow. General Butler was the most popular one. If General Butler had been an ambitious man like Aaron Burr and had been willing to be the man on the white horse for the plotters, do you think their conspiracy to take over the White House with all that money behind it might have succeeded? Well, if General Butler had not been the patriot he was, and if they'd been able to maintain secrecy, the plot certainly might very well have succeeded, having in mind the conditions existing at that time. Remember interrupting here that he says, basically, if Butler hadn't been of the orientation that he was, and if they had maintained secrecy, the plot would have succeeded. We're going to examine events that happened later and ask the question, did they succeed at a later date? Continuing. No one can say for sure, of course, but when times are desperate and people are frustrated, anything like that could happen. And we might have gone fascist? If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. They wouldn't have told the people what they were doing, of course. They were going to make it all sound constitutional, of course, with a high-sounding name for the dictator, and a plan to make it all sound like a good American program. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. He failed with his beer hall putsch, but he succeeded when he was better organized. The same thing could have happened here. So, again, that this, despite the denials from the people who were involved, there was a very, very real attempt at a fascist coup in the United States in 1934, backed by some of the most powerful and most prominent members of American society, whose firms, whose the industrial and financial firms that they worked through, dominate the United States today. Firms like General Motors, DuPont, the Morgan Bank, and so forth. Of course, we've looked at that in connection with the funding of Nazi Germany. The point is that this same group was ready, willing, and able to establish fascism in the United States.
Okay, from a little further on in the plot to seize the White House, this is a transcription of, not a transcription, but it's a, I can't think of the term right now, but basically it's a literalization of the testimony of Major General Smedley D. Butler when he was talking about his conversations with Gerald McGuire, this attorney who contacted Butler on behalf of the, quote, fraternity, as author Charles Higham had had it in the other book, as this author had had it. Anyway, so this is not the translation, which we have too, but this is just the author's putting this into expository form. But that's the Butler that he's referring to, is Major General Smedley D. Butler, who at this point is leading the attorney, Gerald McGuire, on about what this organization can do and will do. There was only one Morgan in the financial world. The attorney has just referred to backing from Morgan, J.P. Morgan and Company. McGuire left no doubt in his mind, Butler's mind that is, that the nation's biggest financiers were indeed involved. According to the bond salesman, there had been a meeting in Paris to decide upon the selection of the man to head the superorganization. McGuire and his group had held out for Butler, but the Morgan interests distrusted the general as, quote, too radical, preferring Douglas MacArthur instead. MacArthur's term as chief of staff expired in November. And the Morgan interests felt that if Roosevelt failed to reappoint him, he would be bitter enough to accept their offer. Butler observed that MacArthur would be likely to have difficulty in lining up veterans behind him because his dispersion of the Bonus Army had made him highly unpopular. The Bonus Army was, of course, the army of World War I soldiers who were not getting the pensions that they felt were due to them and marched to Washington en masse in a peaceful protest, and Douglas MacArthur took a bunch of troops out at the order of, I believe it was, Coolidge, but I could be wrong. No, it was Hoover, and dispersed these unarmed American veterans who just wanted their pension benefits. McGuire, again, the attorney, indicated that the Morgan coterie's second choice was Hanford McNider, an Iowa manufacturer who was a former commander of the American Legion. But McGuire emphasized that his own group was still insisting that Butler was the only military leader in the country capable of rallying the veterans behind him. The Morgan interests had acknowledged Butler's immense prestige and popularity, he revealed, but were apprehensive that as head of the paramilitary force, Butler might lead it in, quote, the wrong direction. Butler observed that McNider would have no more popular appeal than MacArthur, because he had gone on record as opposing the Bonus. McGuire then revealed that McNider would be cued to change his stand, and would do so. Butler remembered this prediction when, 3 weeks later, McNider suddenly reversed his position and came out in support of the bonus. Okay, so inserting this quickly, McGuire is claiming to have this internal control and to know what's going on behind the scenes and letting Butler in on how well connected these men are and how well they're how good they are at manipulating things. They're saying Butler says McNider would not be a popular leader because of his opposition to this bonus for World War One veterans who were all of them out of work because of the Depression, and McGuire tells him that's all right. McNider's going to reverse that position, presumably to make himself more popular in case he did wind up being the contingency leader of this coup d'etat. If Butler could not be persuaded to head the new superorganization, McGuire said, the offer would definitely be made to MacArthur, whether or not the latter was reappointed chief of staff. He confided that there would be an administration fight over MacArthur's reappointment, but he would get it, meaning MacArthur would get the appointment, because he was the son-in-law of Philadelphian Edward T. Stotesbury, a Morgan partner, Stotesbury, S-O-T-E-S-B-U-R-Y. It was a bold prediction, since never before in American history had a chief of staff been allowed to succeed himself. Butler was all the more startled and impressed with McGuire's sources of information when his prediction came true several months later.
Okay, now, the connection here that's really, really important is the fact that General Douglas MacArthur, whose staff we're going to look at great length and connect up with all of these fascist groups here and connect up with fascist machinations for about a 50-year period from the early 30s to the present time. Basically, Douglas MacArthur was an in-law of a very prominent member of the Morgan Financial and Industrial Group, a man named Edward T. Stotesbury. I'd like to read you a little piece of information now from a book called 1,000 Americans. That was a book authored by a very famous anti-fascist writer named George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S. We've used his work before on this program. And 1,000 Americans by Seldes was published in hardcover by Bonnie and Gair, B-O-N-I and G-A-E-R, copyrighted 1947. Now, one of the last things in this book is a table which basically documents the amount of money contributed by various key American industrialists and financiers to various domestic American fascist organizations. And under the S section, we find under Stotesbury, E.T., recall the father-in-law of General Douglas MacArthur, a contribution of $1,000 to a fascist group called the Sentinels. And remember that $1,000 was a lot more in the 1930s than it is now. But MacArthur's father-in-law, Stotesbury, not only is connected to the Morgan Financial Group, but was an active financer of fascist causes at times. And remember that MacArthur was the first choice of the Morgan DuPont fascist plotters to replace Roosevelt by heading up this veterans group. However, they felt that MacArthur did not have the requisite popularity. So we're beginning to see how MacArthur fits into this thing. Again, we're not impugning Douglas MacArthur directly, nor are we excusing him. As we say, if he was not a doctrinaire fascist, he has to have been one of the stupidest men of all time because he allowed some outright and outspoken fascists to surround him and to operate much of the military apparatus that was underneath him. So again, if he was not himself a doctrinaire fascist, he must be regarded as one of the great incompetents of all times, at least from a political standpoint.
Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. You're listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day weekend, Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special, a mouthful if ever there was one. And the program itself is quite a mouthful. This is the story of the cooperation between American corporations and the fascist powers of World War II, something that has profound implications for the present. What we're going to do next is to go directly to the next half-hour side of this program. This is a tribute to George Seldes, and this was done in July of 1995. I actually recorded the bulk of this program on a Sunday night. That's when the One Step Beyond show is heard and is aired here on KFJC. And then the next day I read George Seldes' obituary. So I read his obituary into the end, into the record at the end of a replaying of the half hour that was recorded. recorded the day before. I had not known when I concluded my One Step Beyond show with a half hour of material from Seldes' landmark works that, in fact, he had passed away that day at the age of 104. Also, note in this half-hour segment that you're about to hear that the aforementioned Smedley Butler, the Marine Corps Major General and two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, who was selected to lead the 1934 coup attempt, was the focal point of the wrath of Herbert Hoover, who in 1931 tried to court-martial Smedley Butler for slandering Mussolini. How about that, huh? Anyway, we're going to listen to a half hour, a tribute to George Seldes, as well as some more excerpting of his landmark work. This segment is a half hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. We're going to continue now with the prepared portion. By way of giving some background to a number of things that we're going to be talking about in weeks to come, we're going to be talking about Germany. We're going to be talking about the remaking of the Bundeswehr, the German army, into an offensive force. We're going to be talking about Germany's foreign policy, its national security policy, the reemergence of the Nazi elements that were never effectively purged from Germany, and a number of very, very disturbing things on the European political horizon. The primary factor underlying the failure of denazification in Europe at the end of World War II, Germany in particular, the root explanation for that failure really lies here in the United States. I've dealt at great length with the terrifying and ongoing reality of fascism in the United States. Fascism is not something alien to this country. Many of our most prominent industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist. Some of them would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg had President Roosevelt lived. That's something, by the way, that's discussed in the new book, The Secret War Against the Jews, by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. We've also dealt with the 1934 coup attempt. In fact, in Radio Free America program number 10, I deal with the 1934 coup attempt by way of analyzing the evolution of American fascism over the decades. That was a coup attempt in the United States organized by industrialists and financiers, primarily grouped around the House of Morgan. They were embittered by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, considered him a traitor to his social class, and undertook to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and replace him with a Mussolini-style dictatorship. The general that was tabbed to lead that coup attempt, fortunately, although a conservative and quite critical of Roosevelt in many respects, was a genuine patriot and a genuine Democrat with a small d, and so he betrayed the coup plotters' plans to Franklin Roosevelt. There was a tragically attenuated congressional investigation, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which looked into the fascist coup attempt. I replay that segment of Radio Free America number 10 every Memorial Day as part of the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Memorial Day special. And that's the discussion of the 34 coup attempt is to be found within two archive shows. One, Radio Free America number 10, and also the Family Values program that I did after the 1994 off-year elections. By way of gaining some historical perspective about the degree to which fascism was something that had become accepted by what, for lack of a better term, one could call the American power structure, we're going to take a look at a couple of items, and we are going to draw once again on the magnificent research of George Seldes, viewed by many as the Dean of American Investigative Reporters, an individual whose landmark work on fascism is something that we have dealt with at great length in the past. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of excerpts from one of Seldes' books entitled Even the Gods Can't Change History, subtitled The Facts Speak for Themselves. It's by George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S, published by Lyle Stewart and Company out of New Jersey, and this is copyright 1976. In Appendix A of Even the Gods Can't Change History, there is a remarkable anecdote concerning an impending court-martial of the aforementioned Major General Smedley Butler, two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor and a Commandant of the Marine Corps, for having slandered Mussolini in a discussion with President Herbert Hoover. once again, what we're talking about here is a major general in the United States Marine Corps facing a court-martial. It was aborted for reasons we'll discuss in a minute. A court-martial for insulting Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. As we've seen in the past, drawing again on the research of George Seldes, Mussolini was named a member of the American Legion, an honorary member of the American Legion in 1935. That nomination later rescinded on a technicality. We're going to discuss Smedley Butler's almost getting court-martialed for having slandered Mussolini to then-President Herbert Hoover right now. In Appendix 4, rather, not Appendix A, Appendix 4 of Even the Gods Can't Change History, we find the following. By the way, most of the information in this book is reprinted from George Seldes' remarkable In Fact series. That was a magazine that he had in the 1930s and 40s. Appendix 4 reads, in 1931, Major General Smedley D. Butler, Commandant of the U.S. Marines, faced court-martial because of an alleged insult to Mussolini. Inasmuch as the present editor of this weekly was in 1931 engaged in writing Sawdust Caesar, he placed at General Butler's disposal the true facts concerning Mussolini. As a result of this association with the Commandant of the Marines, here is a news story which has not yet been told. President Hoover wanted to court-martial General Butler to please fascist Italy. In 1931, in a speech in Philadelphia, Butler had repeated a story previously told by Cornelius Vanderbilt, that while Mussolini and he were driving through an Italian town, the Duce was a confessed speed lawbreaker. He ran over a child and then made the following remark. Never look backward, Vanderbilt. Unquote. What is one life in the affairs of state? Again, unquote. Butler called Mussolini a wild, mad dog, unquote. Hoover ordered Secretary of the Navy Charles Adams to prefer charges. If found guilty, General Butler could have been dismissed or given 15 years imprisonment. When In Fact's editor gave General Butler the documented history of Mussolini's political murders, including the Filippelli confession of Mussolini's part in the assassination of Matteotti, General Butler said he did not think President Hoover would ever let the case come to trial. Interrupting, we've dealt with the assassination of Member of Parliament Matteotti, a socialist deputy in the Italian Parliament, who exposed the connections between Mussolini and many of the top industrialists and financiers of Italy, at whose will, Mussolini did what he did. Basically, as George Seldes, whose work we drew upon in the archive show of Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. We drew on not only the book Sawdust Caesar, alluded to here, but also Can These Things Be, from 1931. And the assassination of Matteotti was discussed in that miscellaneous archive show available from Archives on Audio. Continuing with this segment of Even the Gods Can't Change History, Hoover sent his aide to see me, said Butler. I said, put me on the stand and you'll hear the story of the Boxer Rebellion, unquote. That was all. General Butler was released almost immediately. And George Seldes goes on to describe a very shameful episode during the Boxer Rebellion in which Herbert Hoover, then an engineer, was basically found cowering in a corner when General Butler stationed Tianjin with the United States Marines discovered him. I'm not going to go into the particulars concerning Herbert Hoover's cowardice during the Boxer Rebellion. However, I think it's worth noting here that General Butler, again, not only the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, but also a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, was going to be court-martialed for slandering Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. This by way of gauging the fascist sentiments within some segments of the American military. Again, I'm not stating that this is true of all or even most American military personnel. I don't want to be misunderstood on that score. Indeed, I think it is pretty obvious that if there were more military people of this sentiment, we would not be as relatively well off as we are these days. One of the many remarkable and very disturbing chapters in Even the Gods Can't Change History concerns the activities of some reactionary American congressmen and also the House Un-American Activities Committee, a body with which William Mandel, a regular guest on this program, clashed some time back. The attempts, successful for a period of time, by elements of the House Un-American Activities Committee and reactionary American congressmen to suppress General Marshall's Army Fact Sheet number 64, Fascism. This concerned an information document that was to be distributed to American troops informing them about fascism, what it comes from, how it operates, and included in that was how to recognize domestic American fascists. It's worth noting that this document was actively suppressed by reactionary elements in the United States, and we are examining it now by way of hoping to understand some of American history. We should note again that many of our most prominent industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist. There were connections, profound connections, pivotal connections between American corporate interests and those in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany before and during the war, and those business relationships, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, continued after the war as well. Again, in the recent book, The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus and Mark Ahrens reveal, drawing on intelligence sources, that had President Roosevelt lived, he was going to institute a banker's trial for some of the world's financiers who had helped to finance Hitler and Mussolini. Prominent in the defendant's box at the banker's trial would have been many American industrialists and financiers. Of course, Roosevelt did not live, so that trial never happened. As in future weeks, we proceed with an examination not only of the reemergence of German fascism, but of the terrifying nationalism that Germany is manifesting now, and of the synthesis between foreign policy, economic policy, and military policy in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. It's worth understanding that the seeds of much of what is taking place right now were sown at the end of World War II, and the failure to denazify Germany, the failure to denazify the German army, the responsibility for that, really, lies largely with the United States. And indeed, as we shall see, attempting to inform the American army about fascism, while indeed the American army was engaged in a war against fascism, was no mean feat. And the fascist elements in the United States, very, very powerful elements they were very successful for quite some time in getting General George Marshall's fact sheet number 64 suppressed. Seldes writes about this in Even the Gods Can't Change History. Rankin, with the help of his chief counsel, Ernie Adamson, that's a reactionary congressman, Rankin, R-A-N-K-I-N, with the help of his chief counsel, Ernie Adamson, collaborated with the Hearst Washington Bureau and destroyed the Marshall Enlightenment Plan. And it was a noted Hearst member of that same bureau who sent the story to, in fact, by the way, interrupting in Radio Free America program number one, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 1, we dealt with the very favorable press given to fascism in, among other publishing empires, the Hearst publishing empire. There were front page editorials by people like Rudolf Hess, Mussolini, Goering, Alfred Rosenberg, assuring people that fascism was not only a good thing, but that the fascist leaders of Europe wanted nothing but peace. Continuing. Rankin first heard of the Marshall Program when Representative Adolph Sabath of Illinois, one of InFact's original subscribers, placed the entire contents of one of its issues in the Congressional Record. It was a reprint of Marshall's Fact Sheet number 64, Fascism. This is what Marshall was trying to tell our Army. 1. After explaining Japanese, German, and Italian fascism with its terrorism and mass murders, the pamphlet suggests that not all fascists speak in the language of their countries. Some speak ours. 2. Could fascism rise in the United States after it is crushed abroad, and what can we do to prevent it? Unquote. 3. Fascism is contrasted with democracy. It is then stated that at various times in the United States we have had lynchings, vigilantism, and suppression of civil liberties, and certain fascist elements such as the Black Legion and Pelley's Silver Shirts are actually named. Also mentioned are, quote, religious bigots, unquote, not named. This part concludes, quote, all of them in the name of Americanism, unquote. 4. any fascist attempt to capture the United States, quote, would work under the guise of super patriotism and super Americanism, unquote. Again, these bullet points are points, central points in George Marshall's fact sheet number 64. By the way, they get that to be distributed to the United States Army. Continuing, 5. Soldiers are advised that it is proper to call members of the Communist Party communists, or Reds for short, but pinning these labels on people whose politics one opposes, quote, is a favorite trick of native as well as foreign fascists, unquote.